From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Record producer and songwriter Alan Toussaint was one of the most important behind-the-scenes figures in the development of the New Orleans sound in the early days of rock and roll. Monday, he'll be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll feature an interview with Toussaint. Also, we remember record producer Nick Vinay. He made over 300 records and worked with such performers as the Beach Boys, Linda Ronstadt, and Frank Zappa. We spoke with him after he'd co-produced a box set of recordings by his longtime close friend, Bobby Darin. Vinay had produced some of the original sessions collected in the box. Vinay died last week. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Two balloonists attempting an around-the-world flight parachuted to safety just 2 hours into their flight after a helium cell in their balloon burst today. Pilots Dick Rutan and Dave Melton had lifted off this morning from Albuquerque in their quest to become the first people to circle the globe nonstop by balloon. Their failure comes on the heels of adventurer Steve Fawcett's aborted flight, which ended earlier this week. Two balloonists in Switzerland will be the next to try. Hundreds of thousands of people across New England and northern New York are without power as a major ice storm hits that region for a second straight day. Mike Tyke with North Country Public Radio reports.
Another half inch of freezing rain fell overnight across the region. In Vermont, forecasters say a month's worth of precipitation has fallen in the last 24 hours. In New York, the National Guard has been called in to assist with downed trees, power lines, and flooding from ice jams. Paul Ford is a spokesman for Niagara Mohawk Power, whose 100,000 customers without power will have to wait for a while longer.
Actually, we're probably worse off right now than we were 24 hours ago. The ice buildup is continuing. We're talking days.
Hundreds of emergency shelters have been set up around the region, and emergency officials say more will likely open today as more freezing rain is expected to fall. For NPR News, I'm Mitch Tyke in Canton, New York.
Prosecutors and defense attorneys in the trial of Unabomber suspect Theodore Kaczynski are to confer today with the psychiatrist who will examine him. The doctors must report to the court on whether Kaczynski is competent to stand trial and whether he can represent himself. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he will decide the size of a West Bank pullout before he meets President Clinton in Washington on January 20th. His comments came as U.S. Envoy Dennis Ross wrapped up his latest mission to Israel. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The prime minister is trying to walk a narrow line between the Clinton administration, which is losing patience with his delay in implementing the next withdrawal from the West Bank, and hardliners in his government. They have threatened to pull out of his coalition and bring the government down if Netanyahu carries out any pullback. Israeli officials say Palestinians must first implement their commitments to crack down on terrorism before Israel will withdraw. Palestinians reject any delay. They say Netanyahu continues to expand Jewish settlements as part of a West Bank land grab. Israel this week announced it will build more than 600 new homes in two West Bank settlements. And that may be only the beginning. The Haaretz newspaper today reported that Israel has plans to build 30,000 new homes in the West Bank. That would almost double the number of Jewish settlers there. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 117 points in heavy trading. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is sliding for the fourth straight session. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner has details from New York.
There is continued concern that the Asian financial crisis will negatively impact U.S. corporate earnings. Last night, President Clinton pressured Indonesian President Suharto to implement changes that the IMF says are needed to rebuild confidence in its battered economy. The U.S. is considering the release of a $3 billion rescue plan to Indonesia. Deputy Treasury Secretary Lauren Summers is traveling to Jakarta to assess whether the government is following through on promised economic reforms. Overnight, the Hong Kong stock market fell by nearly 4%. There was also weakness in the major European equity markets. The concern about the fallout from the Pacific Rim is overshadowing a much stronger-than-expected report on December employment. Non-farm payrolls rose by 370,000, although in a separate survey, the unemployment rate edged higher to 4.7%. I'm Doug Krisner.
Inventories of unsold goods on wholesalers' shelves rose slightly in November. The Commerce Department says the buildup included both long-lasting durable goods, such as furniture and machinery, and also non-durable, such as groceries and medications. Shares of Adaptec are down about 30% in early trading on the NASDAQ. The maker of computer data flow systems says it expects its earnings to fall well below analyst estimates for the third quarter. It blames a charge based on a change in accounting principles. The company that makes the pink fiberglass insulation material says its pricing is getting a little thin. As a result, Owens Corning is cutting 2,200 jobs, or 9% of its workforce. It will also close a plant in Quebec. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's 13th induction ceremony will take place Monday at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York. On this archive edition, we'll hear from one of the new inductees, songwriter and producer Alan Toussaint. He was one of the key figures in the creation of the New Orleans sound. In the early 60s, Toussaint produced, wrote, and arranged hits by Ernie K. Doe, Irma Thomas, Aaron Neville, and Benny Spellman. Toussaint's songs include Mother-in-Law, Working in a Coal Mine, and Lipstick Traces. More recently, he's worked with the Pointer Sisters, Bonnie Raitt, the Judds, and Elvis Costello. Now he's showcasing talented but virtually unknown New Orleans performers on his record label NINO, an acronym for New York, New Orleans, the two cities that are home to his recording studios. In 1988, Toussaint told me he made his recording debut back in 1957, playing piano in the style of Fats Domino for some of Domino's own recordings, including this one, I Want You to Know.
I want you to know I love her so well, and I love her so much I can never, never tell. Oh boy.
That was a popular during that time to play like other people. I hadn't established who I really was yet, so if they wanted someone who would play like others, like Ray Charles or Fats Domino, they could very well call me and know they would get what they were looking for. We were up to two tracks at that time, a multi-two-track recording, and Fats Domino was out of the country, and Dave Bartholomew, who was his producer and writer on many songs, called me in to play like him, like Fats Domino would play on a song called I Want You to Know, and one another called Something About a Little Schoolgirl. And I went in and played, and that was sort of a milestone in my early getting started.
So you had to play exactly in his style. You already had his style down from listening to records?
By all means, yes. Everything. Mistakes and all.
When you filled in for Fats Domino, was that supposed to be a big secret? Were you supposed to not tell anyone that that was actually you playing on his record?
Oh, no, that was never mentioned. But no one really got to know that in the public generally, because that kind of information isn't usually publicized. But it never was hush-hush among the musical community. The guys around knew, and it was kind of fun.
Now, in 1959, when you were around 21, Minute Records opened, which became one of the most important of the New Orleans record companies. And you were the house arranger, pianist, and composer. That company was really known for creating a New Orleans sound. What do you associate with that New Orleans sound? What kind of rhythms do you think of? What kind of arrangement?
I think, in short, syncopation. The kind of syncopation that was inspired by the street bands. By street bands, I mean the second line bands that were early originated for funerals. In fact, it goes back longer than any of us can remember. But the syncopation, the horn licks that sort of associate with that kind of band. And I think that was largely responsible for how the New Orleans beat turned out to be for that period.
Now, what did you listen to growing up that made that such a natural sound for you?
Professor Longhair, foremost for his New Orleans people. Fats Domino, of course. And I listened to everyone, however, as a young child, I thought that all pianists played everything. I mean, I thought anything on piano, any piano music, all pianists played it. So I tried a little Bach, a little Professor Longhead, a little Alfred Ammons, Boogie Woogie, some Strauss waltzes, some Liberace. I really came into my senses later to find out that you can't really do it all. But as an early child, I tried to play every kind of music that I heard. I thought everyone was doing that.
And then you learned they weren't.
Oh, yes, and I learned I weren't.
One of the first national hits that you had, a hit that you, a song you wrote and produced and arranged, was Mother-in-Law, the Ernie K. Doe record. This was back in 1961. I want to play some of that record, but tell us the story behind how you wrote it.
Well, I wrote that along with four other songs that day. During that period, all of the artists would gather in the front room of my parents' home, and I would write one song for one artist. We'd all sing it, and then I'd write another for another, and we'd all sing that one, and the first artist would sing background behind the other. That's how sometime Ernie Cato would sing background for Aaron Neville. Aaron would sing background for Irma. But Mother-in-Law was written the same day as Tainted the Truth, Want a $10,000 reward, and Hello, My Lover. And we had a great time with it. When I first wrote it, when Ernie Cato first attempted to sing it in the front room, it didn't come off nearly the way I thought it should have in my mind. So I wanted to discard that song like I had done so many others. And Ernie Cato took it out of the trash can as I was writing a song for someone else and say, man, let's give this another try. And we did, and I'm so glad that he did.
Let's take a break from our 1988 interview with Alan Toussaint to hear a performance he gave earlier that year in our studio of his song, Mother-in-Law.
The worst person I know, mother-in-law. Mother-in-law, mother-in-law, every time I open my mouth, she steps in and try to put me out. How could she stoop so low? Mother-in-law, 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 mother-in-law. Why Satan could have been her name, mother-in-law, mother-in-law. To me, they're about the same. Mother-in-law, mother-in-law, if she'd leave us alone, we would have a happy home. Sent from down below, mother-in-law, 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 mother-in-law. I come home with my pay, mother-in-law, mother-in-law. She asked me what I've made. Mother-in-law, mother-in-law. She thinks her advice is a contribution, but if she would leave, that would be the solution. And don't come back no more. Mother-in-law, mother-in-law, mother-in-law.
Alan Toussaint singing, and at the piano, let's get back to our interview with Toussaint. I want to ask you about another song that you wrote, another one that was a hit, and this is Working in a Coal Mine, which Lee Dorsey was the first to record, another song you wrote, arranged, produced. What's the story behind this song?
Well, Lee Dorsey has inspired many, many wonderful songs as far as I'm concerned, and I only can afford to call them wonderful because I know they are more part of him than they are of me, even though I wrote the entire songs. Lee Dorsey would inspire songs that just wouldn't come from any other source, like Took a Little Trip to Mexico. There's no reason for that. I didn't take a little trip to Mexico or anything like that at that time. But Working in a Coal Mine was one that we liked when we went in to do it, but it didn't really come together in the studio as it should. And Marshall Seahorn took and put a razor to the tape, which we which is a term for splicing the tape, and put the first part on the end and made it a complete recording, which was good for all of us because we do like the final, we did like the final product. But as far as working in the coal mine, lots of folk ask me, how was it inspired? Do I know anything about coal mines? Not at all. Nothing more than what I've seen in the movies.
So why did you write about coal mines?
I don't know.
It just came to you.
That's Lee Darcy again. When he's around and I hear his voice in my head, things come.
Well, let's hear this recording, Working in a Coal Mine, written and produced by my guest, Alan Toussaint.
Working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine, about to slip down.
5 o'clock in the morning, I'm already up and gone. Lord, I'm so tired. How long can this go on?
Yeah, they're working in a coal mine, going down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down.
Working
in a coal mine,
going
down, down, down.
Working
in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down.
'Cause I make a little money on a coal by the tongue, but when Saturday rolls around, I'm too tired for having fun.
Too tired for having, I'm just working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down.
Working
in a coal mine,
going
down, down, down.
Working
in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down.
That's Working in a Coal Mine, performed by the late Lee Darcy, written and produced by my guest, Alan Toussaint. The group that basically became your rhythm section was the Meters, and then you also produced hits for them. And they were the Meters basically was the Neville brothers, and you had been working with singer Aaron Neville for years, I mean, since close to the beginning of your career, right?
Well, something like that, yes. Of course, the last part, working with Aaron for many, many years, yes. When I first began writing for recordings, Aaron was there, yes. And Art Neville's I recorded as a single artist also. When I first saw the Meters, they were going by the name of the Neville Sounds, which was only one Neville in them. It was Art Neville's. It so happens he was the leader of the band. And the Meters was one band that he had put together, like many others. And I must say that he's a natural leader, because every time he's ever put a band together, it's been very special and very unique. And the Meters was no exception, of course.
What was it about their sound that attracted you, that you wanted to use in your records?
Total syncopation, popping everywhere. Every musician in the Meters, it was only four of them, but they all were playing percussion on their instruments. The guitarist was playing percussion, the bass player was playing percussion, and of course, organ. Art Neville's was on the organ. Very percussive group, and Zig on drums was just outrageously wonderful.
You've written some songs under the name of Naomi Neville.
Right.
Are you any relation to the Neville brothers?
We don't know. Naomi Neville is my mother's maiden name. And I used that for some good business reasons, I thought, earlier. I was underage when I was with a company, and when I became of age, I was about to change companies, and until that was ironed out in the courts, I used a pseudonym, which was my mother's maiden name. I just wanted to keep a name that was in the house in case the computer made a mistake. At least it would come to the same house.
Alan Toussaint, recorded in 1988. Monday he'll be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Coming up, we remember record producer Nick Vinay. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Record producer Nick Vinay died last week of Burkitt's lymphoma. He was 61. He produced over 300 albums, CDs, box sets, and compilations in the course of his career. He started his record career in the late 50s, working for Capitol Records, where he signed the Beach Boys and produced their early recordings. He produced albums for Linda Ronstadt, Ricky Nelson, Glenn Campbell, and Frank Zappa. We spoke with Vinay in 1996, after he co-produced a terrific Bobby Darin box set on Rhino Records called As Long As I'm Singing. Vinay had also produced some of the original sessions in the box set. Vinay and Darin had been close friends ever since they were teenagers, first trying to make it in the music business. We invited Vinay on the show because we were fans of Bobby Darin, but we ended up really liking Vinay, so we want to replay this interview for you. We started by playing Bobby Darin's first big hit, Splish Splash, recorded in 1958.
Splish Splash, I was taking a bath long about a Saturday night. Yeah. A rub-a-dub, just relaxing in the tub, thinking everything was all right. Well, I stepped out the tub, I put my feet on the floor, I wrapped the towel around me and I opened the door, and then a splish splash, back in the bath. Well, how was I to know there was a party going on? There was a splishing and a splash.
Nick Vinay, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you.
Do you know the story behind why and how Bobby Darin recorded this song?
Well, Bobby wanted to be a crooner. He wanted to be a pop singer. But he knew he had to do certain things to get on the charts and sell records. And this was his way of taking a shot at it, to at least get some fame going. And this was worked out. He knew what he was doing when he made this record.
You know, it's I'd be lying if I said it's a favorite of mine. I think his rhythm in it is really great, but it's really a dumb song. And I was thinking, when I was listening back to it, who foisted this song about on him, when I realized he wrote it?
He wrote it. He wrote it. He was inspired by a title that disc jockey's mother gave him. And he always said he wrote the song in 10 minutes, but he was saying that because the song shouldn't have taken more than 10 minutes. He worked very hard on this song. He just put everything in it he thought would make it a hit.
Now, I want to play the demo of another early hit that he had, Dream Lover. And, wow, this demo's great. His singing on it is so good, and it's much more stripped down. It's very stripped down, so it's different from the very produced hit recording of this song. Now, tell me the story behind this demo.
Well, he felt that if the song didn't make it with people, if they really didn't get the message with just him and a guitar. By the way, the guitarist is Fred Neil. At that time, Fred had written a song called Candyman for Roy Orbison, and he also wrote Everybody's Talking for the Schlesinger film, Midnight Cowboy. He wanted to try something which wasn't being done at that time. Everything was very, and that period of time, everything was cute and pretty. And he wanted to do something that was not cute, not pretty, but worked on another level. And he tried it with just the guitar to see how it would affect people. And it affected everyone. And he knew he had a song that would possibly transcend a certain amount of time. And he made the demo at the session with just Fred playing the guitar. And then later on, everybody asked him to add more. And he did. And he went on. And, of course, it was a hit. Either version will make it for me, too. But that version's real special because it's just Bobby and the guitar, and he sings it as well as he sang anything else.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. 'Cause I need a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, where are you? With a love oh so true, and the hand that I can hold and feel you near as I grow old. 'Cause I need a girl to call my own.
I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
That's Bobby Darin's 1959 demo of his song Dream Lover. My guest Nick Vinay co-produced the new Bobby Darin box set when was Bobby Darin's longtime friend and sometime producer. How did you meet Bobby Darin?
We were both in our teens, I guess, and we were working at the Brill Building in New York. The Brill Building was the music mecca of pop music, I guess, at that time. And it was centrally located, and we met a lot of people, like Burt Bacharach had an office there, Lee Bernstoler had an office there, and Darin and I rented a broom closet and converted it into an office. And we just wanted a place to put our names on the door. And he wrote songs, and I tried to put records together. The word producer was not being used at that time. And we actually met in the elevator at the Brill Building and several times, and we ate in the same restaurant around the corner. And we just became friends, and a group of us, really. And we started hanging out and using the broom closet as a place to meet. And we kept a piano in there and a place to write and play demos.
So is that where he wrote some of his early songs?
Yes, that's where he wrote all the records we've heard so far. He worked in that little closet, the size of a broom closet, held a piano, and that's about it, and two chairs. And he would work to 3 or 4 in the morning on these songs.
Record producer Nick Vinay, he died last week at the age of 61. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's the title track of the Bobby Darin box set that Vinay co-produced.
As long as I'm singing, there's a bell up in my brain that's ringing, making a crazy ding-dong. And if this band don't desert me, then there's nothing in the world can hurt me. Long as I'm singing my song, give me trumpets, legato, put some saxes with them, strings, pizzicato, and some rhythm. As long as I'm singing, then the world's all right and everything's swinging. Long as I'm singing my song. Making music is more to me than a pleasure, 'cause me and music, we go together like notes in a measure. Long as I'm singing, then the world's all right and everything's swinging. Long as I'm singing my, long as I'm singing my, long as I'm singing my
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our interview with record producer Nick Vinay about his longtime friendship and collaboration with Bobby Darin. Vinay died last week.
I'm not the guy who cared about love, and I'm not the guy who cared about fortunes and such. I never cared much, but look at me now. And I never knew technique of kissing. I never knew the thrill I could get from your touch. Never knew much. Oh, look at me now. I'm a new man, better than Casanova at his best, with a new heart, brand new style. I'm so proud I'm busting my vest. So I'm the guy who turned out a lover,
So I'm the guy who laughed at those blue diamond rings. One of those things, oh, look at me now.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to continue our interview with record producer Nick Vinay. He died last week at the age of 61. Vinay joined us in 1996 after the release of a Bobby Darin box set that Vinay co-produced. Vinay and Darin had been close friends since they met at the Brill Building at the start of their music careers.
What were his aspirations then, and what were yours?
Mine was, except the word producer wasn't... was to direct records and create records. And Darin always wanted to be nothing other than a songwriter and sometimes performer. And songwriting was his main goal at that time. I think that's because being a star or a hit artist probably was too much of a fantasy. Sometimes you have a dream that's too heavy to carry. But being a songwriter was more realistic. And he wanted to be a songwriter, that was very important to him.
How much faith did he have in his singing?
He had more faith in his songwriting than his singing. But as the first couple records he made, of course, you know, did not sell very well. They were bombs. But as he progressed, he felt stronger about his singing. And at some point, he decided that he's going to have to do it with his songs. Because he just felt that he had the interpretation he couldn't give to other people when he just wrote them.
Although he started off with rock and roll hits, he seemed to know early on that he wanted to sing standards and probably end up in Vegas. Now, a lot of rock and rollers in the late 50s and early 60s were groomed to play Vegas, but often against their will. But the feeling was rock and roll is a fad, and unless you learn how to play Vegas, you'll be out of a career by the time you're in your 20s.
Correct.
Go ahead.
That particular time period, you know, we were still coming out of the late 40s. The influence in the 50s was from the adults in the late 40s. And singing was legit singing, and you had to play in a club, and you had to play Vegas and those venues, or you weren't a success. And if you didn't learn to play those places, you would end up doing one-nighters with 20 other acts that had one hit on various disc jockey shows in small towns. And a lot of the rock and rollers could not do the pop situation, and a lot of them could. And the transition was tough for some. There was Paul Anka who made the transition, and there was very few of them, really. And Darin made the great transition.
For a lot of people in rock and roll, listeners and performers, Vegas symbolized everything that was square and unsavory about show business. Why did Bobby Darin want that?
Well, Darin thought that he could actually bridge the gap and bring his audience, and the word teenagers is the word they used, people under the age of 25, he could actually bring them up to where they too would appreciate Sinatra. They'd appreciate Tony Bennett. They'd appreciate pop music. And he tried to cross it. He tried to keep the rhythm and the tempo for dancing situations and for the excitement. And later on, when you get into Mac the Knife, you'll see he did it.
Well, we should hear Mac the Knife. Now, he recorded this when he was 23.
23.
And I know when I heard it when I was young, it was catchy. I don't know. And then in college, I was introduced to the Three Penny Opera, and I thought, boy, that Bobby Darin, he really ruined Mac the Knife. He made it into a showbiz anthem. How horrible of him. And when I listen to it now, I think, what a great recording. What incredible rhythm he has in this. I mean, he transforms the song, but
yes,
he does something really interesting with it.
And I must tell you, that's his concept. It was his idea, and everyone thought he had lost it.
That he was crazy?
He was crazy. They thought they just couldn't believe that he was going to do that, and he did.
Well, why did he choose this song? What did he hear in it? What did he hear in it to swing it? I mean, it's not a song that you think of swinging.
Well, we're dealing with a guy that could go back to the 20s. He knew Frank Tashmatter and Johnny Dodds and the early Dixieland musicians. He was steeped in the music business history and various forms of music. And he loved, personally, Dixieland. Had he had his druthers, born 20 years earlier, he would have been a Dixieland, he would have had a Dixieland band. And what he did is he loved these tunes, Kurt Weill tunes. He just loved them because they were German umpa tunes, you know. They were kind of done in that old style for the show, of course. And he just loved the whole theory, the way the song was written, the mysterious lyrics, you know, their various levels. He thought he could get away with it, and he did. He was just brilliant.
Well, let's hear. Mac the Knife is recorded by Bobby Darin in late 1958.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, baby, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, wears old Maggie Heath, baby, so there's never a trace of red. Now on the sidewalk, ooh, Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life. Eek! And someone sneaking round the corner. Could that someone be Mac the Knife? There's a tugboat down by the river, don't you know, where a cement bag is just drooping on down. Oh, that cement is just, it's there for the weight, dear. Five will get you 10, old Mackie's back in town. Now you hear about Louis Miller, he disappeared, babe, after drawing out all his hard-earned cash. And now Maggie Heath spins just like a sailor. Could it be our boy's done something rash? Ah, Jenny Diver.
Ho, ho!
Yes, Sugi Tawdry. Ooh, Miss Lottie Lenya. And old Lucy Brown. Oh, the line forms on the right, babe. Now that Maggie's back in town. Jenny Diver, whoa, Sugi Tawdry, look out to Miss Lottie Lenya and old Lucy Brown. Yes, that line forms on the right, babe. Not that Maggie's back in.
Bobby Darin. We're listening back to a 1996 interview with record producer Nick Vinay. He died last week at the age of 61. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Back to our 1996 interview with record producer Nick Vinay about his longtime friendship and collaboration with Bobby Darin.
What did the success of Mack the Knife prove, and how did it change his career?
Surprisingly, it didn't change his personality, but what it did change is his thinking. He realized that he had that thing that artists get when they get into the center. They know that their creative ideas are right if they just don't let outside people talk them out of it. And they use their gut feelings. And then he started using his own feelings for picking types of songs and making albums, and it worked. He just avoided talking to too many people because they all had ideas of what was wrong with it. He just wanted to know what was right with it. And so that really gave him the that feeling that he's right and he's an artist and he can come up with great ideas if he keeps them intact.
Now, he was supposed to record Donkashane after
Yes,
Mack
he was.
The Knife. But instead he gave the song to Wayne Newton, and of course the rest is history.
Darin was producing Wayne. Darin had signed Wayne Newton. Wayne was brought to Bobby by Dick Clark, believe it or not, in New York, and we went down to see him playing in a lounge, and he was just terrific. And Bobby signed him as his first act on his Capitol production deal. Bobby was banking for the future. He wanted to produce, and he wanted to publish, and he wanted to run a record company, and slowly over the years taper off from performing, which at that time was becoming more difficult for him physically. And he just didn't want to make it public, so he started getting more involved in production. As you know, Darin didn't have a lot of years.
Well, I'm going to skip playing Wayne Newton's Donkashane because I want to save as much time as we can to play Bobby Darin's music.
Cut that part out, but I don't blame you.
So how did Bobby Darin actually make it to Vegas?
Well, Steve Blauner, his manager, introduced him to George Burns. And George Burns just, you got to understand, Darin, when he walked in a room, he had that presence, that great spirit. Very few people have it, but when they have it, you know it. They walk in a room and everybody stops. They may not be facing the door, but they stop. And George Burns met Darin, and he just felt that thing that Darin had, that this kid is going to be a star. And Darin had already had a couple of records on the charts. And Blauner told Burns that if you take him to Vegas, you won't be disappointed. And he did. And Darin just lit up Vegas. You know, he was one of the highest paid performers ever in his 20s in Las Vegas.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he packed it in. Darin was truly a phenomenon in Las Vegas. It was unbelievable.
Were you in Vegas, too, at that time?
Oh, we used to go up there all the time. Remember, we're two kids, two poor kids from the city. I'm from Baltimore, and he's from New York. And this was dog heaven for us. We were raised that you're successful, you drive Cadillacs, you wear a gold link bracelet on your left hand to tell you who you are, and you wear one on your right hand to tell you who you were. And we did it all. We were foolish like that, but it was worth it. And Vegas to us was just the cat's meow. I can't tell you. We didn't even think it was gaudy. We thought it was neat. We were in our 20s, you know. And it was very exciting because we came from very good people, but very simple neighborhoods.
Well, you know, in his Vegas period, he recorded a lot of jazz standards. And I want to play one of my favorites, which you happen to co-produce. And it's A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square. I think this is a wonderful recording and shows how good his jazz singing is. You were at the session. You co-produced it. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Darin had a great ear and a great respect for other writers. A lot of writers do not listen to other writers, nor do they care about other writers' works. And a lot of artists who write don't listen to other writers or their works. Darin had one of those great feelings about other talent. And he was just always just excited about great writers and a lot of writers and a lot of the great songs. And this particular song is one that he felt he could never ever write a song like this, and the next best thing would be to sing it. He loved it so much, and he did.
That certain night, the night we met, there was magic abroad in the air. There were angels dining at the Ritz, and a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. I may be right, I may be wrong, but I'm perfectly willing to swear that when you turned and smiled at me, a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. The moon that lingered over London town, poor puzzled moon, he wore a frown. How could he know we two were so in love? The whole darn world seemed upside down. The streets of town were paved with stars. It was such a romantic affair. And as we kissed and said goodnight, the nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. How strange it was, how sweet and strange. There was never a dream to compare with that hazy, crazy night we met when a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. Ah, this heart of mine, it beat loud and fast like a merry-go-round in a fair. For we were dancing cheek to cheek, and a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square.
Did Vegas change Bobby Darin's personality, and did success change him?
Success never changed Darin. Vegas never changed Darin. Politics changed Darin. That's what changed Bobby Darin. His political awareness and growth, and his involvement in politics. He went from being a kid raised in the center to a kid that practically became a bomb-throwing leftist politically. And meeting the Kennedys also altered his life. And it altered his ability to play Vegas under certain conditions. Number one, he wanted Vegas to integrate more. He wanted to see more black Americans working at the tables, working in the orchestras, working at the various other jobs, other than the jobs where you didn't see anyone, those faceless jobs in the back. And he became a civil rights worker, quietly.
Did this political awakening lead to the folk part of his career?
Yes. He wanted to stay with the audience that started with him, and he wanted to make the transition with them. For instance, it was okay for you and I to, I don't know how old you are, so I don't know if you were there. He wanted, if I could take and start wearing Levi's and letting my hair grow long and started campaigning for Kennedy, he thought he could do that too, and he didn't understand why people would say he's trying to become a folky. They didn't say Dylan's trying to become a folky. It didn't say I was becoming a folk producer.
But they thought it was phony that somebody with a Vegas pedigree at this point was growing their hair long and singing folk songs.
And it's an interesting thing. He was willing to lose half his audience for his political conviction. But there was a point there when he lost almost all his audience because one group didn't like him going that far to the left, and the other group on the left didn't want him coming over because they didn't trust him. He was in between a rock and a hard place.
We're listening back to a 1996 interview with record producer Nick Vinay. He died last week at the age of 61. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Back to our 1996 interview with record producer Nick Vinay about his longtime friendship and collaboration with Bobby Darin.
Let me actually play one of his folk songs, one of the songs that he wrote and that he used to close his show with, and it's called Simple Song of Freedom. Now, we're going to hear a demo version of it, I believe previously unreleased, that's featured on this box set. And you were there when he recorded the demo. In fact, I think the tape machine was on your lap.
Yes.
Tell us about this.
Darin had been working on the song. And what he wanted to write was This Land Is Your Land. He wanted to write a song that people could take with them, they could sing with them. And he worked very hard to simplify this. And it's a statement of the time. I get very emotional when I think of it. But he finished it that morning, and he put it on the tape recorder. I held the tape recorder on my lap and held the mic up, and that was the final version. In fact, there's a mistake in it, but he kept going. And he said, "That's my anthem." And he closed his shows forever after that with that song.
Why don't we pause here and listen to Bobby Darin's demo of his song, Simple Song of Freedom.
Come and sing a simple song of freedom. Sing it like you've never sung before. Let it fill the air, tell the people everywhere that we the people here don't want a war. Hey there, Mr. Black Man, can you hear me? I won't dig your diamonds or hunt your game. I just want to be someone known to you as me. And I will bet my life you want the same. So come and sing a simple song of freedom.
You know, this the song that we heard the demo of, Simple Song of Freedom, his actual studio version of that wasn't released until after his death.
Yes, yes.
And there's, yeah, go ahead.
No, it's just that there were a lot of things on tape that weren't released during his lifetime. He just felt sometimes he wasn't ready to release it, and he had so much he wanted to do, he was afraid to release a lot of things. It might hurt his schedule. And he was a man racing against time, I promise you.
He died of a heart condition. How long was he aware that he had a heart condition? Did he always know that?
Yes, he did. He knew that from when he was a small kid, when he was in his when he was 8 or 9 years old, he understood that. He also understood he wasn't going to make it to 21. And then then the new diagnosis said 30. We're the exact age, and he passed away at 36, 37. He outlived the sentences they gave him of how long he was going to live, but he also knew that he had pressed his luck. We did a lot of gambling. We loved Las Vegas, and he used to say, "I'm playing it like it lays." Towards the end there, he used to say, "Boy, I'm pressing my luck, but I'm going to double up," and that was his phrase all the time. He said, "We'll go in the studio. I'm going to double up and see if I can do an album while I still have the energy." He was wearing down towards the end.
You co-produced the new box set of Bobby Darin's work, which is divided into his rock work, his pop work, and his folk and country. What was it like for you to sit down and listen back to all of this?
It was tough. It was tough. The mistakes were bigger. The best parts were better. And it's always tough going back. Darin, we shared a lot of philosophy. I know that Darin never grew old, not because he died young. If he was alive today, he still would not be old. Darin was not an old person. He was young. He would have been young now. And going back over these things, you see the amount of time and years and the places. It's very difficult to do a box set. I've worked with other box sets on people I've worked with, but this one was the toughest because we had put so much time and space between all the songs. We were everywhere: New York, Nashville, Chicago, L.A., Las Vegas, Miami. It was one of those times when this country was on the move.
I'd like to close with a song, and I'm going to let you pick this one. I'd like you to pick and to introduce a song that you particularly love or that has special significance for you.
I'd like to play Beyond the Sea.
And why do you want to choose this?
Darren would go up to Pfeiffer Beach all the time and Big Sur. And that's where he did his best thinking towards the end. And he would whistle Beyond the Sea on the beach. And I'd walk, oh, a quarter of a mile behind him because he wanted me to see how the sound sounded when the wind brought it back. He was still planning on recording a new version of Beyond the Sea at Pfeiffer Beach. It just means a lot.
Nick Vinay, recorded in 1996 after the release of the Bobby Darin box set As Long As I'm Singing, which Vinay co-produced. Vinay produced over 300 albums, CDs, and compilations. Vinay died last week at the age of 61 of Burkitt's lymphoma.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover stands on golden sands and watches the ships that go sailing. Somewhere beyond the sea, she's there watching for me. If I could fly like birds on high, then straight to her arms I'd go sailing. It's far beyond a star, it's near beyond the moon. I know beyond a doubt my heart will lead me there soon. We'll meet beyond the shore, we'll kiss just as before. Happy we'll be beyond the sea, and never again I'll go sailing.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Just as before, happy we'll be beyond the sea.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.